Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Thank you guys once again for joining the 980s podcast hosted by yours truly, Kevin Thompson, founder and CEO of 9i Capital Group. Thank you guys for joining us. As I always say, subscribe to the channel. As I always say, go and get my book, MLB to CFP live on Apple and Amazon. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can email us at info@9icapitalgroup.com. Send us your questions. Go to the website at www.9icapitalgroup.com. Schedule your appointment. Also, follow us at MLB to CFP on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. As you know, we're here to do what? Educate, power, engage, and also entertain. And today, we're here to entertain you. We're talking to David Enrich, New York Times business investigator and author of Dark Towers, Deutsche Bank, Donald Trump. This thing reads like a spy novel. And we're talking about homicide, suicide, and how one of the biggest banks in the world almost brought down the global financial system. You don't want to miss this episode. David Enrich, welcome to the show. Let's get it. We have David Enrich here on the 980s podcast, talking about this book. I'm going to tell you this. There's two things that I've learned about this book. One is Deutsche Bank is a wild organization. It's a wild organization. But two, how many damn times can you give a guy some money and he go bankrupt on it? But we'll get to that point. But David, thank you for joining the 980s podcast today, my friend.
My pleasure.
So let's start here. Deutsche Bank, what made you, what pushed you to make this type of a book? Where did the idea come from to kind of just go into this world of shadowy banking and just financial destruction?
Yeah, well, it's kind of interesting. I had been working at the Wall Street Journal in London starting in 2010, and I'd been covering the banking industry in the US before that. And then I moved to London, and it was just kind of the start of this big European financial crisis. Yeah. And Deutsche Bank was the biggest, baddest, most screwed up institution in the continent at the time. And, you know, reporters gravitate toward carnage. And Deutsche Bank was like, it was just the source of the greatest carnage, probably the greatest carnage in the world at that moment. So I was fascinated by it. But it was kind of, it struck me as impenetrable, really. I mean, I didn't speak German. And it was just, it wasn't like a traditional bank, right? It had these huge Wall Street operations. It was really complicated. I didn't have as good an understanding of the kind of inner workings and how kind of the nitty gritty of finance as maybe I needed. But I just started kind of poking around, and then there's a tragedy, and it turned into a big break for me, which was that a senior executive there who lived in London killed himself. And a couple of colleagues and I started hearing rumors in London that part of the reason for his suicide was that he had been concerned about stuff that was going on at the bank. And so a few of us started kind of fanning out to family members and friends, trying to talk to them about what had happened, which is a terrible thing to do. Like, it's just, you know, no one's in the mood to talk to you. And I got assigned, like, we kind of divvied up the family members. And one of the people who I was in charge of reaching out to was this, his son, whose name was Val. And Val, after quite a bit of back and forth, Val eventually agreed to start talking to me. And he was a real character, but he kind of eventually, over a period of years, brought me inside, or helped me kind of get an inside look at what had been going on with his father. And that provided this just like really unique vantage point to understand the inner workings of this bank. So it was kind of a lucky break in a way.
Well, so we're talking about homicides, suicides, the amount of carnage that went through the Wall Street, I guess, inside of Wall Street between like 2000 and 2020. I mean, it's got to be something where people got to start thinking, wow, something's wrong with our banking system if people are wanting to jump, well, fall out of buildings backwards, right? Fall out of buildings, or people are found in alleyways around schools. It's always certain banks that are doing certain things. And one thing that you've noted about Deutsche Bank was that their workings with quote unquote suspect members around the financial industry. What do you think, well, how much of the carnage has to do with its workings with quote unquote the Russians or mafia members or suspect entities?
So that's it's kind of a tough question to answer and I don't know is the short answer. I mean, look, There's the big unifying theme across all of these banks where you've seen death and destruction in many forms is a single word, which is greed. Yeah. These banks, obviously, as any company would, exist to make money, but especially in the period and leading up to the U.S. financial crisis and then the global financial crisis and then the European financial crisis, they were just running in a completely out of control fashion. Yeah. And one manifestation of that was that institutions like Deutsche Bank, but by no means limited to Deutsche Bank, were doing all sorts of really kind of corrupt and often illegal stuff, whether it was engaging in money laundering, cozying up to corrupt Russians, doing stuff that appeared to be related to the mob, and all sorts of stuff. And for Deutsche Bank, this is part of a long kind of infamous history. I mean, this is a bank that helped finance the Holocaust and in the years leading up to and during World War II. And then as now, the unifying thing, I think, was a desire to build as quickly as possible, make as much money as quickly as possible, and not really have much of a moral compass about how they were doing that and what the laws were, or even just what like normal ethics or morality might dictate. And when you have a situation where greed is the dominant overriding priority, people who do have consciences and try to act on their consciences find that troubling and can find themselves stuck. And that's what happened in the case of Bill Brooksmith, whose son I ended up spending a lot of time with. And that was definitely at least part of what happened with him. And it's a pattern that's repeated itself, not just at Deutsche Bank, but all over Wall Street in the past 20 years.
Yeah. And like you mentioned, the cause of the financial crisis, all these derivatives, they were packaging loans, making a ton of money and understanding that, these risks are involved, but hey, the money's too good on the other side of the fence, man. We got to keep these loans going. We got to keep these repackaging these mortgages and all these things, these loans from these companies and these Trump loans, quote unquote, keep repackaging them. Let's keep selling those things because you know what? It's good for business and he's giving us money. So let's go to the man, the myth, the legend. You hate him, you love him, doesn't really matter. But Donald J. Trump, the newly elected president, defaulting on multiple loans. I believe he's had four defaults in his time. After defaulting on the $700 million bonds in the Taj Mahal casino, he found a lifeline with Deutsche Bank. What made Deutsche Bank willing to take such a risky client when other institutions on Wall Street said no?
Yeah, I mean, he was a pariah on Wall Street. And again, it's the same word, greed. And that's the very simple answer. The slightly longer answer is that Deutsche Bank at the time where Trump came looking for money, which was in the late 90s, early 2000s, after he had defaulted and burned all these other banks and investors, Deutsche Bank at the time was trying to build a reputation in the U.S. and a name for itself. And most people couldn't even pronounce its name. There was, I don't want to pollute. Yeah, exactly. I don't want to, Abby, you said that, not me, but there's, so the bank was eager to find new sources of business and also find kind of prominent splashy clients that would help from a marketing standpoint. And so here is Trump, who desperately needs a source of credit and financing. And here's Deutsche Bank that desperately needs to make an inroad into the American market. And so they're kind of a match made in heaven. And the bank, at least initially, was willing to kind of cast aside the concerns about whether he would actually pay back the money. And they viewed it in part as essentially a marketing expense. And that, I mean, the crazy thing, and I don't want to kind of jump ahead too much here, so tell me to stop if you want. But
No, go ahead.
Yeah, the crazy thing is that, and so he, going into the relationship with Deutsche Bank, Trump had previously defaulted on loans and bonds with other banks.
Yeah.
And then that process, not surprisingly, starts again at Deutsche Bank. And Deutsche Bank was such a large and disorganized and poorly run institution that he could default on a loan arranged by one division of Deutsche Bank. And the place was so messed up that there wouldn't be enough communication internally, so that a different arm of Deutsche Bank would come along, not realizing that the other, its sister unit, had basically forbidden itself from doing business with him in the future. And so you had different arms of Deutsche Bank almost competing against each other for Trump's business, even as he then began to default on loans and other deals that Deutsche Bank had done for him. So this was it was not just that he had burned other banks and other institutions. He burned Deutsche Bank repeatedly, and yet the bank, like a glutton for punishment, kept coming back for more. And it was really, I've never seen anything like it.
Well, it sounds like you're talking about the United States government. No, I'm just kidding. Right? I'm just kidding. We're not talking to each other. Yeah.
It's true, though. I mean, you have a huge institution with different interests and people not talking to each other. I think that's actually, I know you're kidding, but that's actually not the worst comparison.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny because not only were these loans continually defaulted on, but they were non-recourse loans. And on top of that, sub 3% or lower.
Yeah.
How in the hell can you, a risky borrower, come and say, hey, I need to get, $150 million. Can you get it to me? No. Okay. Well, I'll go. I got another bank's gonna. I get all these other banks out here. They're fighting for this deal. So I'm giving it to you guys. Yeah, we have a good relationship.
He played them.
Oh my God.
He played them. I mean, it's that simple. And there was, and look, it wasn't always. It didn't always end terribly for Deutsche Bank. And there were a bunch of loans that it did, both back in the late '90s and continuing and up through 2015. And some of them didn't default, and Deutsche Bank made money on them. I mean, I would argue that the reputational damage they incurred from those loans later on probably more than made up for the whatever profits they made on the loans. So, and because they've been, Deutsche Bank has been swept into all of these investigations. It's endured like brutal, like PR damage. I mean, he was Trump. For all his sins and all his flaws, is really good at projecting an image of confidence and getting people to believe in what he is pitching. And at the time, what he was pitching was that he is a famous real estate developer who will not only work his magic and get these deals, the real estate deals, to be profitable, but also that the problems that he had had in the past where he had defaulted on loans, whether it was his casinos or other deals, that there were idiosyncratic problems that were associated with those that weren't really his fault, and that therefore this new loan that he's proposing, or the Deutsche Bank was proposing, wouldn't be quite as risky as it might look superficially. Now, that turned out often to be BS, and the record speaks for itself. I mean, he not only defaulted prior to Deutsche Bank, he defaulted on Deutsche Bank loans repeatedly as well, and yet Deutsche Bank, as I said, kept coming back for more.
And the term force majeure. He tried to use a legal term that can basically get you out of things because of externalities that are beyond your control.
Yeah.
Right. And the bank says, okay, I know he did that, but he's a good, let's give him some more money. And then not only that, Jared Kushner, let's give him some money. I mean, it's just mind boggling to me.
Well, the force majeure thing is especially crazy, right? Because not only does he try to wriggle out of responsibility, this was a big loan that Deutsche Bank did to finance his skyscraper in Chicago.
Yeah.
And then the financial crisis comes. Trump decides he's going to stop paying back the loans. And he argues that the financial crisis was an act of God that therefore voids his contract. Takes a lot of like chutzpah to make that argument. But on top of that, he then sues Deutsche Bank for having caused the financial crisis and claims that Deutsche Bank, not only does he not have to repay his loan, but Deutsche Bank owes him damages because it caused the financial crisis that hurt his building. I mean, that is a bold argument to make. And then on top of it, before he's even repaid that loan, Deutsche Bank comes back and shoveling him more money. Again, it's a different division of Deutsche Bank that wasn't communicating with the division that had been burned on the Chicago loan. But this pattern just, again, I'd been covering at the time that I wrote this book, which was 5 years ago. I can't even remember. Like, I had been covering Wall Street and banking for like 10 or 15 years, and I had never seen anything like this. And to this day, I've not seen anything like this. It's the bank threw good money after bad time and time again.
And so how much, I guess this is aside, how much responsibility does Deutsche Bank have in regard to the financial crisis? I mean, reality. Yeah. I know we don't, we could throw percentages out there and we don't necessarily know, but at the end of the day, were they truly the epicenter, or was it just something that they were just like, hey, it's just risk across the world. Everyone's doing it.
No, they were pretty aggressive. I mean, they definitely, I wouldn't say that they were like the main culprit or anything, mm-hmm. but they were, I mean, the thing that Deutsche Bank was doing and a few other big financial institutions like Goldman Sachs were
Lehman
doing.
Brothers.
Yeah. I mean, Lehman was definitely much more responsible than Deutsche Bank. Like much more, like had much more to do with this. AIG had more to do with this.
Yeah.
But I mean, Deutsche Bank was really playing both sides of the U.S. mortgage game. And it was not only, it had a business that was helping to finance and create subprime mortgages in the U.S. And then it was also separately instructing things like collateralized debt obligations, which is a phrase I have not said in a few years, thankfully. But doing things like that were basically designed to profit if the subprime mortgage market collapsed. So it like some of its peers was really playing both sides of the game and ended up making a ton of money during the financial crisis as a result of that. And in fact, it emerged from the 2008 crisis as people thought it was one of the stronger financial institutions in the world because it had not incurred huge losses. And in fact, had made like a boatload of money on these kind of short-term trades that it had been doing. And in hindsight, that turned out to be, it really lulled the bank and its executives and investors into this, and regulators as well, into a really false sense of security, because they kind of spun it like they had such good risk management and were so clever that they had avoided the carnage of the crisis. And in fact, they had delayed their day of reckoning because they were sitting on so many derivatives that were going to go bad in the near future. And you know, they had an opportunity after the 2008 crisis to really fortify themselves and maybe raise capital and get rid of some of the risk on their balance sheet. And they just didn't because they were greedy.
What's funny, all you got to do is tell people, hey, you get this thing done for me, you can come down to Mar-a-Lago and hang out.
Yeah.
You want to go golfing? You know what I mean? And these guys are like, oh, I get to go to Mar-a-Lago. And they, next thing you know, they're just pushing this thing. And then guess what? Guess what? I didn't say that.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it was classic Trump, right? And he like was not satisfied that Deutsche Bank sales guys were doing a good enough job selling his bonds. Offered the trip to Mar-a-Lago if they could pull it off. They pulled it off, and then he claimed that like he tried to weasel out of it. And that said, he ultimately, after the bank called him out on this, he did come through and sent his private jet up to New York to take people down to Mar-a-Lago. And I think from the perspective of those sales guys, it was worthwhile. They had this bizarre kind of once in a lifetime experience with the guy who now is, or has been and will be, the president. It's pretty remarkable.
Let's go there. So now 2016, 2017, president-elect, Deutsche Bank thought, no shot. This is not even going to be close. Hillary's going to win this thing. That's fine. And they don't. And as long as he doesn't win, they're not going to come and open our books. So we're good. Yep. Next thing you know, he won. Oh, hell. What are we going to do?
I think that was the morning. I can't remember what the date was, but that Wednesday morning, I guess, in November 26th. Yeah, whatever that morning was a pretty bad day at Deutsche Bank. I mean, they had earlier in that year, in 2016, they had, and by the way, I should say in fairness to the bank, that like everything hit the fan, and then they brought in new management and started slowly at first, but started to try and clean things up and become, you know, less bad. And so by 2016, when Trump was running, it was under this new management, and they, I think they were kind of apoplectic about the Trump relationship, among many other things. And in fact, earlier in 2016, before the election, but Trump was obviously running by then, they tried to really pare back their exposure to Trump for exactly this reason. But again, no one or very few people thought Trump was actually going to win in 2016.
Yeah.
He wins, and then Deutsche Bank realizes that the Democrats and the media and law enforcement, like, this is a real problem they have all of a sudden, because the president of the United States, they are his biggest creditor. That, I mean, it's just, it's kind of unimaginable that, you know, the incoming president would be deep in debt to one of the world's biggest banks, and it happens to be a bank that's like largely supported by the German government. So it's not even, it's not even an American institution. And it's funny, like, this is, you know, this is more than 8 years ago at this point. And I feel like some of the weirdness of that moment has faded a little bit, because we've just been treated to so much like unusual, unconventional stuff over the past decade.
Yeah.
But at the time, it was really, it was almost inconceivable. Like, it was just very surreal.
Man, your book paints a wonderful picture on how the lengths of what these banks and the extremes they're looking to go find profit. So I guess my next question to you is, do you think Deutsche Bank's story is unique in amongst Wall Street, or is it more indicative of a broader culture in a global financial industry?
Yeah, it's definitely the latter. I mean, it's unique in a lot of ways, right? It's an idiosyncratic mess. I've never seen such a poorly run large institution in my life. like, I really haven't. But that being said, it's definitely,
I mean, Bear Stearns, Lehman, I mean, those
right.
places went back.
That's
though,
fair. So I guess you're right. That, I mean, that's fair. I wasn't, you know, it's funny, before I went to London, I was covering my, like, at the Wall Street Journal, we had these very specific narrow beats. So my main responsibility was covering Citigroup.
Okay.
And Citigroup gave Deutsche Bank a run for its money, actually. That was also a very poorly run institution. But
Hey, wait, before you go any further, I got two names, Bank of America and Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo has got its problems.
I guess a better way of answering the question is, which is that clearly, as we've just both ticked off like a half dozen names of terrible financial institutions that have caused just huge damage to customers, to investors, to taxpayers, like, it's indicative of a broader thing, right? This Street was afflicted with this just systemic rot and greed for a really long time. And I mean, I think some lessons have probably been learned. And the systemic rot and greed is maybe a little bit, it's probably substantially less than it was like in 2007, 2008. But, you know, one of the things that if you look back in history, you can see is that this pendulum swings over and over again, decade after decade. And it obviously swung very far in one direction leading up to the 2008 financial crisis. And then it swung right back in the other direction because regulators came in, prosecutors came in, investors were like furious because they had lost all their money investing in these banks. Yeah. And so there's a lot of more conservatism on the banking industry. But what we are starting to see now, whether it's with the banks or non-bank financial companies, like, there is right now a lot more risk coming back into the system, and especially with an administration, with the Trump administration coming in. And one of the things they did the last time, and I expect they'll do again, for better or for worse, is reduce the kind of day-to-day oversight of Wall Street firms and banks and make it easier to take risks. And, you know, risks are good to take. That's what banks are supposed to do. That's why they can lend money. But when the risks are grow out of control or hidden or get too big, that, I mean, we've just seen this over and over and over again over the past 150 years. It causes destruction, great destruction.
It's capitalism on the way up, socialism on the way down.
And it's totally.
And it's sad because it just happened again. Oh, well, these Silicon Valley Bank and all these, I'm like, God dang it, guys. Like, stop with the, what have you not learned the last time we went through this, you know? And then what do we have to do as taxpayers and the government? We're going to back you guys. Don't you worry. You don't have to pull your money out.
And it's not even very good socialism, right? Because it bails out the banks and their investors and their executives. But like the people, the individual people who lose their homes or lose their fortunes or lose their investments, like, they ultimately pay the price for this greed and this risk taking.
But what are they going to say? They're going to say, But we're the engines of capitalism. We're the reason they have jobs. If you don't do this for us, they're going to lose their jobs. They're going to lose their home. They're going to lose everything. And they're holding us hostage right now. Corporations, the big ones, and this is off the topic, but they're holding us hostage right now in our society with that too big to fail moniker. It's got to stop, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I hear you. The tricky thing is that it's like, on the one hand, it's not fair. On the other hand, they're probably right that if huge banks do collapse, that, I mean, look what happened in 2008, right? You had Lehman collapse, you had AIG collapse, like, and that was really, I mean, millions of people all over the world lost their jobs, lost their livelihoods. So that's not good either. I think the solution in general, which is also really hard, is to prevent these banks or any institution in the economy or the financial system from getting so big in the first place that they can hold all of us hostage. But that's hard. And that means making sacrifices sometimes. And it's not, but clearly the cleanup system that has been used in the past is just flagrantly unfair to normal human beings. It's very good for the executives and their highly paid employees who, you know, make money when times are good, but don't seem to lose much when times are bad. But for the rest of us, you know, kind of sucks.
The only thing that I would say about that is the only reason the United States wants larger banks is, of course, for a global footprint, but it's to combat China. Like, if you have state-owned banks that are so large that can control how money flows across the world, you have to have large banks to combat that as well. And that's the reason why we have our banks so large. It would benefit us to have to chop these banks up and like, hey, okay. But I mean, they want to compete, right? They want to compete.
Yeah, well, and I kind of get it also. I just don't think there's like a good, easy solution here because we do want big banks, right? Like we have big companies that need to borrow lots of money that have really complicated financial needs all over the world. We want to have our companies that employ a ton of people and make a ton of money for our economy be able to go with, you know, open an office in London or open an office in China and be able to sell things all over the world and whatnot. And having a big multinational banking system in the US is really helpful for that. The problem is that if those risks grow out of control or in ways that are not visible to the regulators or to investors or sometimes to the banks themselves, which is one of the many crazy things about Deutsche Bank, is that they didn't even internally understand the risks they were taking. And when that starts to happen, it is really, really dangerous.
Really dangerous. And final question, my friend. And this has been phenomenal, man. The book was great. Reads like a spy novel. Like I said, I was shocked at the amount of carnage. The death, the despair, the homicides, the quote unquote suicides that were involved in this. It was just amazing. What do you hope readers take away from your book, and especially in understanding the intersections of politics, power, and finance?
Wow. I don't know. That's a good question.
I ask good questions, my friend.
You do ask good questions. I think in general, I've written a few other books as well, and I tend to tackle topics that are complicated, but that maybe aren't quite as complicated as they initially seem. And I think finance is a perfect example of this, where the people who are running big financial institutions and often working at big financial institutions have an incentive to make things seem a lot more complicated than they really are. And so which leads people to think that they are indispensable and that these things are so complex that normal people can't possibly understand them or try to kind of counter them at times. And I guess one of my takeaways, or one of my hopes, is that by understanding how this stuff works, you'll realize that it's actually not quite as complicated, that a lot of the financial mumbo jumbo is designed to obscure rather than illuminate. And when you boil things down to their essence, like any like normally intelligent person can get it. And once you start understanding this stuff, you realize that the risks and rewards in the financial system are pretty skewed and you can act accordingly. You can at least, like, if you're an investor with like a medium amount of money, you can put your money, you can make sure that you're investing in things that you understand at the very least.
What do you mean? You mean I can't just go out and borrow $500 million at less than 3% and not pay it back?
Well, I don't know you, man. You've got the former baseball player label. I know I can't.
David, thank you, man, for shedding light on this. fascinating topic. Dark Towers, wonderful read. Everyone should go out. You got a new book coming out. We'll get to that one here. I can't wait for that to come out as well. But that's next on the list. Let the listeners know where they can find your book and how they can follow your work.
I need a website. I don't actually even have a website, but you can Google my name. And my last name is E-N-R-I-C-H. My first name is David. And you'll find it. I've got 4 books. I've got a lot of stuff that I write for the New York Times. You can follow me on all the normal social media
channels. Well, what we'll do is we're gonna plug the book in the feed here for everybody to get. David, thank you for joining the 90s podcast, my friend. This has been a wonderful experience. And again, if you want a loan, you know where to go get it. Thanks for joining, my man. I appreciate you.
My pleasure.
We just had David Ehrenreich, New York Times, and Dark Towers, talking about Donald Trump, the issues there, Deutsche Bank, the several issues there, and just the financial system altogether. It's a wonderful, wonderful read. I'll tell you this. The system is not fair. The system is not fair. Trump said it, and Trump's using the system, and it's not fair. And all I will say is this. You have to understand the system to know how to use it. And it's important to be educated around the system to understand how the financial system works, to use it to your advantage, whether it be Chapter 11 or anything else. So thank you guys. Thank you, David, for joining the 90s podcast. Subscribe to the channel. Go and get my book, MLB to CFP, live on Apple and Amazon. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can email us at info@99capitalgroup.com. Send us your question. Go to the website at www.99capitalgroup.com. Schedule an appointment. As you know, we're here to do what? Educate, empower, and engage, and also entertain. Today, we talked to David Ehrenreich, Dark Towers, wild situation, homicide, suicide, all things aren't equal, my friend. Stay humble, stay safe, my friends. I'll see you again soon.